His soship was driven sometimes to his wits' end by his trimming between the general dislike of the Catholic religion at home, and his desire to wheedle and flatter it abroad, as his only means of getting a rich princess for his soship's wife, a part of whose fortune he might cram into his greasy pockets. Prince Charles, or as his soship called him, Baby Charles, being now Prince of Wales, the old project of a marriage with the Spanish king O.T.M.'s daughter had been revived for him, and as she could not marry a Protestant without leave from the Pope, his soship himself secretly and meanly wrote to his infallibility, asking for it. The negotiation for this Spanish marriage takes up a larger space in great books than you can imagine, but the upshot of it all is, that when it had been held off by the Spanish court for a long time, Baby Charles and Steenie set off in disguise as Mr. Thomas Smith and Mr. John Smith, to see the Spanish princess, that Baby Charles pretended to be desperately in love with her, and jumped off walls to look at her, and made a considerable fool of himself in a good many ways, that she was called Princess of Wales, and that the whole Spanish court believed Baby Charles to be all but dying for her sake, as he expressly told them he was. That Baby Charles and Steenie came back to England, and were received with as much rapture as if they had been a blessing to it. That Baby Charles had actually fallen in love with Henrietta Maria, the French King O.T.M.'s sister, whom he had seen in Paris, that he thought it a wonderfully fine and princely thing to have deceived the Spaniards, all through, and that he openly said, with a chuckle, as soon as he was safe and sound at home again, that the Spaniards were great fools to have believed him. Like most dishonest men, the prince and the favorite complained that the people whom they had deluded were dishonest. They made such misrepresentations of the treachery of the Spaniards in this business of the Spanish match, that the English nation became eager for a war with them. Although the gravest Spaniards laughed at the idea of his soship in a warlike attitude, the Parliament granted money for the beginning of hostilities, and the treaties with Spain were publicly declared to be at an end. The Spanish ambassador in London, probably with the help of the fallen favourite, the Earl of Somerset, being unable to obtain speech with his soship, slipped a paper into his hand, declaring that he was a prisoner in his own house, and was entirely governed by Buckingham and his creatures. The first effect of this letter was that his soship began to cry and whine, and took Baby Charles away from Steenie, and went down to Windsor, gabbling all sorts of nonsense. The end of it was that his soship hugged his dog and slave, and said he was quite satisfied. He had given the prince and the favorite almost unlimited power to settle anything with the Pope as to the Spanish marriage, and he now, with a view to the French one, signed a treaty that all Roman Catholics in England should exercise their religion freely, and should never be required to take any oath contrary thereto. In return for this, and for other concessions much less to be defended, Henrietta Maria was to become the Princeatium's wife, and was to bring him a fortune of 800,000 crowns. His soship's eyes were getting red with eagerly looking for the money, when the end of a gluttonous life came upon him, and, after a fortnight at EMS illness, on Sunday the 27th of March, 1625, he died. He had reigned 22 years, and was 59 years old. I know of nothing more abominable in history than the adulation that was lavished on this king, and the vice and corruption that such a barefaced habit of lying produced in his court. It is much to be doubted whether one man of honor, and not utterly self-disgraced, kept his place near James I. Lord Bacon, that able and wise philosopher, as the first judge in the kingdom in this reign, became a public spectacle of dishonesty and corruption, and in his base flattery of his soship, and in his crawling servility to his dog and slave, disgraced himself even more. But a creature like his soship set upon a throne is like the plague, and everybody receives infection from him. Chapter XXIII. England under Charles I, Baby Charles became King Charles I, in the 25th year of his age. Unlike his father, he was usually amiable in his private character, and grave and dignified in his bearing, but, like his father, he had monstrously exaggerated notions of the rights of a king, and was evasive, and not to be trusted. If his word could have been relied upon, his history might have had a different end. His first care was to send over that insolent upstart, Buckingham, to bring Henrietta Maria from Paris to be his queen, upon which occasion Buckingham with his usual audacity made love to the young Queen of Austria, and was very indignant indeed with Cardinal Richelieu, the French minister, for thwarting his intentions. The English people were very well disposed to like their new queen, and to receive her with great favour when she came among them as a stranger. But, she held the Protestant religion in great dislike, and brought over a crowd of unpleasant priests, who made her do some very ridiculous things, and forced themselves upon the public notice in many disagreeable ways. Hence, the people soon came to dislike her, and she soon came to dislike them, and she did so much all through this reign in setting the king, who was dotingly fond of her, against his subjects, that it would have been better for him if she had never been born. Now, you are to understand that King Charles I, too, of his own determination to be a high and mighty king, not to be called to account by anybody, and urged on by his queen beside us, deliberately set himself to put his parliament down and to put himself up. You are also to understand, that even in pursuit of this wrong idea, enough in itself to have ruined any king, he never took a straight course, but always took a crooked one. He was bent upon war with Spain, though neither the House of Commons nor the people were quite clear as to the justice of that war, now that they began to think a little more about the story of the Spanish match. But the king rushed into it hotly, raised money by illegal means to meet its expenses, and encountered a miserable failure at Cadiz, in the very first year of his reign. An expedition to Cadiz had been made in the hope of plunder, but as it was not successful, it was necessary to get a grant of money from the Parliament, and when they met, in no very complying humour, the king told them, A, to make haste to let him have it, or it would be the worse for themselves. A.T.M. not put in a more complying humour by this, they impeached the king O.T.M.'s favourite, the Duke of Buckingham, as the cause, which he undoubtedly was, of many great public grievances and wrongs. The king, to save him, dissolved the Parliament without getting the money he wanted, and when the Lords implored him to consider and grant a little delay, he replied, "Ah, no, not 1 minute." A.T.M. He then began to raise money for himself by the following means among others. He levied certain duties called tonnage and poundage which had not been granted by the Parliament, and could lawfully be levied by no other power. He called upon the seaport towns to furnish, and to pay all the cost for 3 months of, a fleet of armed ships, and he required the people to unite in lending him large sums of money, the repayment of which was very doubtful. If the poor people refused, they were pressed as soldiers or sailors; if the gentry refused, they were sent to prison. 5 gentlemen, named Sir Thomas Darnall, John Corbett, Walter Earle, John Heveningham, and Everard Hampden, for refusing were taken up by a warrant of the King O.T.M.'s Privy Council, and were sent to prison without any cause but the King O.T.M.'s pleasure being stated for their imprisonment. Then the question came to be solemnly tried, whether this was not a violation of Magna Carta, and an encroachment by the king on the highest rights of the English people. His lawyers contended no, because to encroach upon the rights of the English people would be to do wrong, and the king could do no wrong. The accommodating judges decided in favour of this wicked nonsense, and here was a fatal division between the king and the people. For all this, it became necessary to call another parliament. The people, sensible of the danger in which their liberties were, chose for it those who were best known for their determined opposition to the king, but still the king, quite blinded by his determination to carry everything before him, addressed them when they met, in a contemptuous manner, and just told them in so many words that he had only called them together because he wanted money. The Parliament, strong enough and resolute enough to know that they would lower his tone, cared little for what he said, and laid before him one of the great documents of history, which is called the Petition of Right, requiring that the free men of England should no longer be called upon to lend the king money, and should no longer be pressed or imprisoned for refusing to do so. Further, that the free men of England should no longer be seized by the King of TMS special mandate or warrant, it being contrary to their rights and liberties and the laws of their country. At first the King returned an answer to this petition, in which he tried to shirk it altogether, but, the House of Commons then showing their determination to go on with the impeachment of Buckingham, the King in alarm returned an answer, giving his consent to all that was required of him. He not only afterwards departed from his word and honour on these points, over and over again, but, at this very time, he did the mean and dissembling act of publishing his first answer and not his second, merely that the people might suppose that the Parliament had not got the better of him. That pestilent Buckingham, to gratify his own wounded vanity, had by this time involved the country in war with France, as well as with Spain. For such miserable causes and such miserable creatures are wars sometimes made. But he was destined to do little more mischief in this world. One morning, as he was going out of his house to his carriage, he turned to speak to a certain Colonel Fryer who was with him, and he was violently stabbed with a knife, which the murderer left sticking in his heart. This happened in his hall. He had had angry words upstairs, just before, with some French gentlemen, who were immediately suspected by his servants, and had a close escape from being set upon and killed. In the midst of the noise, the real murderer, who had gone to the kitchen and might easily have got away, drew his sword and cried out, "Aye, I am the man." ATM His name was John Felton, a Protestant and a retired officer in the army. He said he had no personal ill will to the Duke, but had killed him as a curse to the country. He had aimed his blow well, for Buckingham had only had time to cry out, "A villain! ATM," and then he drew out the knife, fell against a table, and died. The council made a mighty business of examining John Felton about this murder, though it was a plain case enough, one would think. He had come 70 miles to do it, he told them, and he did it for the reason he had declared, if they put him upon the rack, as that noble Marquis of Dorset whom he saw before him had the goodness to threaten, he gave that Marquis warning, that he would accuse him as his accomplice. The King was unpleasantly anxious to have him racked, nevertheless, but as the judges now found out that torture was contrary to the law of England, it is a pity they did not make the discovery a little sooner. John Felton was simply executed for the murder he had done. A murder it undoubtedly was, and not in the least to be defended, though he had freed England from one of the most profligate, contemptible, and base court favourites to whom it has ever yielded. A very different man now arose. This was Sir Thomas Wentworth, a Yorkshire gentleman, who had sat in Parliament for a long time, and who had favoured arbitrary and haughty principles, but who had gone over to the people TMS side on receiving offence from Buckingham. The King, much wanting such a man, for, besides being naturally favourable to the King of TMS cause, he had great abilities and made him first a baron, and then a viscount, and gave him high employment, and won him most completely. A Parliament, however, was still in existence, and was not to be won. On the 20th of January, 1629, Sir John Eliot, a great man who had been active in the Petition of Right, brought forward other strong resolutions against the King of TMS chief instruments, and called upon the Speaker to put them to the vote. To this the Speaker answered, "A. He was commanded otherwise by the King, ATM, and got up to leave the chair, which, according to the rules of the House of Commons, would have obliged it to adjourn without doing anything more, when two members, named Mr. Hollis and Mr. Valentine, held him down. A scene of great confusion arose among the members, and while many swords were drawn and flashing about, the King, who was kept informed of all that was going on, told the captain of his guard to go down to the house and force the doors. The resolutions were by that time, however, voted, and the house adjourned. Sir John Eliot and those two members who had held the Speaker down were quickly summoned before the council. As they claimed it to be their privilege not to answer out of Parliament for anything they had said in it, they were committed to the Tower. The King then went down and dissolved the Parliament, in a speech wherein he made mention of these gentlemen as a viper sat mow, which did not do him much good that ever I have heard of. As they refused to gain their liberty by saying they were sorry for what they had done, the king, always remarkably unforgiving, never overlooked their offense. When they demanded to be brought up before the court of King Otiam's bench, he even resorted to the meanness of having them moved about from prison to prison, so that the writs issued for that purpose should not legally find them. At last they came before the court and were sentenced to heavy fines, and to be imprisoned during the King Otiam's pleasure. When Sir John Eliot Otiam's health had quite given way, and he so longed for change of air and scene as to petition for his release, the king sent back the answer, worthy of his Soship himself, that the petition was not humble enough. When he sent another petition by his young son, in which he pathetically offered to go back to prison when his health was restored, if he might be released for its recovery, the king still disregarded it. When he died in the Tower, and his children petitioned to be allowed to take his body down to Cornwall, not to lay it among the ashes of his forefathers, the king returned for answer, "Let Sir John Eliot Otiam's body be buried in the church of that parish where he died." Atm. All this was like a very little king indeed, I think. And now, for 12 long years, steadily pursuing his design of setting himself up and putting the people down, the king called no parliament, but ruled without one. If 12,000 volumes were written in his praise, as a good many have been, it would still remain a fact, impossible to be denied, that for 12 years King Charles I reigned in England unlawfully and despotically, seized upon his subjects' atm goods and money at his pleasure, and punished according to his unbridled will all who ventured to oppose him. It is a fashion with some people to think that this King Otiam's career was cut short, but I must say myself that I think he ran a pretty long one. William Laud, Archbishop of Canterbury, was the King Otiam's right-hand man in the religious part of the putting down of the people Otiam's liberties. Laud, who was a sincere man, of large learning but small sense, for the two things sometimes go together in very different quantities, although a Protestant, held opinions so near those of the Catholics, that the Pope wanted to make a cardinal of him, if he would have accepted that favour. He looked upon vows, robes, lighted candles, images, and so forth, as amazingly important in religious ceremonies, and he brought in an immensity of bowing and candle snuffing. He also regarded archbishops and bishops as a sort of miraculous persons, and was inveterate in the last degree against any who thought otherwise. Accordingly, he offered up thanks to heaven, and was in a state of much pious pleasure, when a Scotch clergyman, named Leighton, was pilloried, whipped, branded in the cheek, and had one of his ears cut off and one of his nostrils slit, for calling bishops trumpery and the inventions of men. He originated on a Sunday morning the prosecution of William Prynne, a barrister who was of similar opinions, and who was fined £1,000, who was pilloried, who had his ears cut off on two occasions, a one ear at a time ear, and who was imprisoned for life. He highly approved of the punishment of Dr. Bastwick, a physician, who was also fined £1,000, and who afterwards had his ears cut off, and was imprisoned for life. These were gentle methods of persuasion, some will tell you, I think, they were rather calculated to be alarming to the people. In the money part of the putting down of the people Otiam's liberties, the king was equally gentle, as some will tell you, as I think, equally alarming. He levied those duties of tonnage and poundage, and increased them as he thought fit. He granted monopolies to companies of merchants on their paying him for them, notwithstanding the great complaints that had, for years and years, been made on the subject of monopolies. He fined the people for disobeying proclamations issued by his Soship in direct violation of law. He revived the detested forest laws, and took private property to himself as his forest right. Above all, he determined to have what was called ship money, that is to say, money for the support of the fleet, not only from the seaports, but from all the counties of England, having found out that, in some ancient time or other, all the counties paid it. The grievance of this ship money being somewhat too strong, John Chambers, a citizen of London, refused to pay his part of it. For this the Lord Mayor ordered John Chambers to prison, and for that John Chambers brought a suit against the Lord Mayor. Lord Say, also, behaved like a real nobleman, and declared he would not pay. But the sturdiest and best opponent of the ship money was John Hampton, a gentleman of Buckinghamshire, who had sat among the Avibursa TM in the House of Commons when there was such a thing, and who had been the bosom friend of Sir John Eliot. This case was tried before the 12 judges in the Court of Exchequer, and again the King of TM's lawyers said it was impossible that ship money could be wrong, because the King could do no wrong, however hard he tried, and he really did try very hard during these 12 years. 7 of the judges said that was quite true, and Mr. Hampton was bound to pay. 5 of the judges said that was quite false, and Mr. Hampton was not bound to pay. So, the King triumphed, as he thought, by making Hampton the most popular man in England, where matters were getting to that height now, that many honest Englishmen could not endure their country, and sailed away across the seas to found a colony in Massachusetts Bay in America. It is said that Hampton himself and his relation Oliver Cromwell were going with a company of such voyagers, and were actually on board ship, when they were stopped by a proclamation, prohibiting sea captains to carry out such passengers without the royal license. But oh! It would have been well for the King if he had let them go. This was the state of England. If Laud had been a madman just broke loose, he could not have done more mischief than he did in Scotland. In his endeavours, in which he was seconded by the King, then in person in that part of his dominions, to force his own ideas of bishops, and his own religious forms and ceremonies upon the Scotch, he roused that nation to a perfect frenzy. They formed a solemn league, which they called the Covenant, for the preservation of their own religious forms. They rose in arms throughout the whole country. They summoned all their men to prayers and sermons twice a day by beat of drum. They sang psalms, in which they compared their enemies to all the evil spirits that ever were heard of, and they solemnly vowed to smite them with the sword. At first the King tried force, then treaty, then a Scottish Parliament which did not answer at all. Then he tried the Earl of Strafford, formerly Sir Thomas Wentworth, who, as Lord Wentworth, had been governing Ireland. He, too, had carried it with a very high hand there, though to the benefit and prosperity of that country. Strafford and Lord were for conquering the Scottish people by force of arms. Other lords who were taken into council, recommended that a parliament should at last be called, to which the King unwillingly consented. So, on the 13th of April, 1640, that then strange sight, a parliament, was seen at Westminster. It is called the Short Parliament, for it lasted a very little while. While the members were all looking at one another, doubtful who would dare to speak, Mr. Pym arose and set forth all that the King had done unlawfully during the past 12 years, and what was the position to which England was reduced. This great example set, other members took courage and spoke the truth freely, though with great patience and moderation. The King, a little frightened, sent to say that if they would grant him a certain sum on certain terms, no more ship money should be raised. They debated the matter for 2 days, and then, as they would not give him all he asked without promise or inquiry, he dissolved them. But they knew very well that he must have a parliament now, and he began to make that discovery too, though rather late in the day. Wherefore, on the 24th of September, being then at York with an army collected against the Scottish people, but his own men sullen and discontented like the rest of the nation, the King told the Great Council of the Lords, whom he had called to meet him there, that he would summon another Parliament to assemble on the 3rd of November. The soldiers of the Covenant had now forced their way into England and had taken possession of the northern counties, where the coals are got. As it would never do to be without coals, and as the King of TM's troops could make no head against the Covenant as so full of gloomy zeal, a truce was made, and a treaty with Scotland was taken into consideration. Meanwhile the northern counties paid the Covenanters to leave the coals alone, and keep quiet. We have now disposed of the Short Parliament. We have next to see what memorable things were done by the Long One. Second part, the Long Parliament assembled on the 3rd of November, 1641. That day week the Earl of Strafford arrived from York. very sensible that the spirited and determined men who formed that parliament were no friends towards him, who had not only deserted the cause of the people, but who had on all occasions opposed himself to their liberties. The king told him, for his comfort, that the parliament should not hurt one hair of his head. ATM But, on the very next day Mr. Pyme, in the House of Commons, and with great solemnity, impeached the Earl of Strafford as a traitor. He was immediately taken into custody and fell from his proud height. It was the 22nd of March before he was brought to trial in Westminster Hall, where, although he was very ill and suffered great pain, he defended himself with such ability and majesty, that it was doubtful whether he would not get the best of it. But on the 13th day of the trial, Pyme produced in the House of Commons a copy of some notes of a council, found by young Sir Harry Vane in a red velvet cabinet belonging to his father, Secretary Vane, who sat at the council table with the Earl, in which Strafford had distinctly told the king that he was free from all rules and obligations of government, and might do with his people whatever he liked, and in which he had added, "Oh, you have an army in Ireland that you may employ to reduce this kingdom to obedience." ATM It was not clear whether by the words "a this kingdom," ATM he had really meant England or Scotland, but the Parliament contended that he meant England, and this was treason. At the same sitting of the House of Commons it was resolved to bring in a bill of attainder declaring the treason to have been committed, in preference to proceeding with the trial by impeachment, which would have required the treason to be proved. So, a bill was brought in at once, was carried through the House of Commons by a large majority, and was sent up to the House of Lords. While it was still uncertain whether the House of Lords would pass it and the King consent to it, Pyme disclosed to the House of Commons that the King and Queen had both been plotting with the officers of the army to bring up the soldiers and control the Parliament, and also to introduce 200 soldiers into the Tower of London to effect the Earl's escape. The plotting with the army was revealed by one George Goring, the son of a lord of that name, a bad fellow who was one of the original plotters, and turned traitor. The king had actually given his warrant for the admission of the 200 men into the tower, and they would have gotten too, but for the refusal of the governor, a sturdy Scotchman of the name of Balfourer, to admit them. These matters being made public, great numbers of people began to riot outside the Houses of Parliament, and to cry out for the execution of the Earl of Strafford, as one of the King's chief instruments against them. The bill passed the House of Lords while the people were in this state of agitation, and was laid before the King for his assent, together with another bill declaring that the Parliament then assembled should not be dissolved or adjourned without their own consent. The King, not unwilling to save a faithful servant, though he had no great attachment for him, was in some doubt what to do, but he gave his consent to both bills, although he in his heart believed that the bill against the Earl of Strafford was unlawful and unjust. The Earl had written to him, telling him that he was willing to die for his sake. But he had not expected that his royal master would take him at his word quite so readily, for, when he heard his doom, he laid his hand upon his heart, and said, "Put not your trust in princes." ATM The king, who never could be straightforward and plain, through one single day or through one single sheet of paper, wrote a letter to the Lords, and sent it by the young Prince of Wales, entreating them to prevail with the Commons that that unfortunate man should fulfil the natural course of his life in a close imprisonment. ATM In a postscript to the very same letter, he added, "If he must die, it were charity to reprieve him till Saturday." ATM If there had been any doubt of his fate, this weakness and meanness would have settled it. The very next day, which was the 12th of May, he was brought out to be beheaded on Tower Hill. Archbishop Laud, who had been so fond of having people's ears cropped off and their noses slit, was now confined in the tower too, and when the Earl went by his window to his death, he was there, at his request, to give him his blessing. They had been great friends in the King's cause, and the Earl had written to him in the days of their power that he thought it would be an admirable thing to have Mr. Hampden publicly whipped for refusing to pay the ship money. However, those high and mighty doings were over now, and the Earl went his way to death with dignity and heroism. The governor wished him to get into a coach at the Tower Gate, for fear the people should tear him to pieces. But he said it was all one to him whether he died by the axe or by the people TMS hands. So, he walked, with a firm tread and a stately look, and sometimes pulled off his hat to them as he passed along. They were profoundly quiet. He made a speech on the scaffold from some notes he had prepared. The paper was found lying there after his head was struck off, and one blow of the axe killed him, in the 49th year of his age.